Hey everybody, welcome to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. I'm your host, Brenton Bickerstaff, and this week on the show we have an interview with Don Carroll. Don spent his career working in fire rescue as a district chief, an academy instructor, and a paramedic. During those 30 years, he raised a family and pursued the meaning of life through extended study into the Cayce readings and other spiritual, scientific, and philosophical materials. Today, Don is a regular speaker and writer of metaphysical topics from Cayce to the Kundalini. He spent 10 years researching and writing his latest work, a book entitled Sacred Geometry and Spiritual Symbolism, The Blueprint for Creation. Don is an international tour leader for the Nonprofit Association for Research and Enlightenment. He visits sites of a spiritual nature all across the globe. Don is also a featured presenter at the upcoming Ancient Mysteries Conference, entitled When the Morning Stars Sang Together, Our Ancient Celestial Origins and Destiny. That's here in Virginia Beach from October 10th through the 13th. If you want to find out more about Don, his website is Donald B like in boy, Carroll, that's CARROLL.com. Here's my interview with Don. Enjoy. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Don. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Brent. It's a pleasure, and thank you very much for inviting me.
Of course. I want to start with maybe an intro question of how did you first get introduced to the ARE and the Edgar Cayce material?
Oh, gosh, that goes back a long way. I would probably the briefest was about 1977 or 78. Saw this book, and I got this book of The Sleeping Prophet by Jess Stern. And when I read it, it just blew me away. It was amazing. It for me, it put so many parts of the puzzle together of spirituality and our purpose and our meaning that it just really clicked for me. And then, of course, then I'm in bookstores looking, well, wait, is there any more Cayce material and authors writing about it? And I found more. And they would have in the back often, you know, about the ARE up in Virginia Beach. And I was like, I got to see this place. Is this place for real? And I took a vacation and flew up here. And they had just maybe 3 or 4 years before I built the visitor center with the library, and I'm a big book reader and an amazing library. And then spent the week there just absorbing it all. And that was really the start. And here, 35 years later, living in the Virginia Beach area and just really continuing learning from the Edgar Cayce readings and the material. It's just phenomenal.
That's amazing. Did you ever see yourself anywhere along your journey being where you are right now, having published a book for the ARE Press or the Fourth Dimension Press? And did you see yourself getting to there?
No, that's, I mean, the material, I was constantly learning from the material and what they were publishing and the readings. And of course, I'm one that looks into the bibliographies for more empirical information and more authors and more reading and more on the material in all the different aspects of it. And, you know, when this book 10 years ago, you know, came as just a couple of ideas in my mind that I wanted to research and just for my own edification. And as, you know, as I researched them with what I was finding, not only in, spiritual and religious and, you know, esoteric traditions, but in science traditions, it really started to take on a life of its own of what I was finding and how it was all fitting together. But it was really for my own learning process and my own learning curve and passion on, trying to understand. And I was kind of collecting it as I learned because I was so amazed by it. I had no idea that it would that this 10-year journey of this research and learning would turn into a book. I would never predicted it, you know, in 1,000 years. But it was absolutely phenomenal and culminated in a book that hopefully people will enjoy. I know it was a terrific learning experience for myself and so expanded my view and my awareness of the our spiritual lives and the symbolism and the sacred geometry, as it's called, of how it all really connects together, both you know, on the in the geometries of science and the symbolisms of science and the spirit and the spiritual symbolism, you know, that kind of culminate in what's generally categorized as sacred geometry that they share. I just hope people, you know, I've had this opportunity to share it, and I hope, you know, people will find, you know, at least some of what I've found in it that is absolutely incredible, that this beautiful unification of all these aspects that are incorporated in it, that there is really, you know, a true oneness. I mean, scientists talk about searching for, you know, a theory of everything, or the grand unified theory, as they call it. And, you know, Aldous Huxley, for one, in his perennial philosophy, kind of showed the shared unification through all religious philosophies. And for me, this is a culmination of both the science and the spirit really showing an amazing unification, what I kind of call bringing, you know, heaven and earth together, or in one analogy of what they call, you know, squaring the circle. You know, it just right. Amazing unification.
For somebody who's not familiar with sacred geometry, how would you give a brief explanation of exactly why these symbols are important?
Sacred geometry is a huge subject. You could fill a library
right.
in it, and it can get very convoluted. I mean, you'll hear about you know, the golden ratio, phi or phi, depending on your pronunciation, the mathematical constant of pi, the Fibonacci numbers, all this. But what I found is that really, and all that is very helpful and fascinating, but I see it is that you can really just look at two geometric symbols that permeate them all, is the parabola or arc, you know, a portion of a circle, and the triangle. And through those, you can really create the rest of sacred geometry and the meanings behind it. You know, the arc basically representing waves or energy, or the more of the infinite, and the triangle, the trinity, representing, you know, energy coming into matter, or spirit coming into physicality. And you see the triangle, a concept of trinity and trinities that are pervasive through all cultures. With those alone, you can create the rest, and you find those same symbols, those very basic symbols, at the basis of really all spiritual and religious symbolism, and the basis of much of the geometries of scientific symbolism, trying to describe much deeper concepts of, you know, the fabric, you know, the fabric of spirit, so to speak, the fabric of the universe, the fabric of ourselves.
Right. And you talk a lot about the pyramids of Egypt in your book, which for me personally has been an incredibly fascinating topic that I've only yet scratched the surface, and is kind of been a big topic of conversation amongst New Age thinkers and people interested in ancient mysteries. What connections did you find to the Edgar Cayce material and the Great Pyramid?
Well, and that was an absolutely fascinating part. I mean, you know, there in the pyramid yourself, you have obviously the triangle symbolism and looking at it, what you could say, three-dimensionally rather than a two-dimensionally. And the Cayce readings give very specific information on it. And, you know, here is a psychic, you know, not giving general information, but very specific information on that and its meanings. I would say one example of that is, in one of his readings, he specifically says that the Great Pyramid was built using a unit of measurement of 27.5 inches. And that caught my attention because it was so specific. And I started researching, okay, a unit of length of 27.5 inches should be easy enough to see if it works using in measurements of the Great Pyramid, you know, and does it work with significant results and significant numbers for the culture, and trying to look at it as the ancient Egyptians would look at it, you know, not from a 21st century concept, but from their aspect of culture. And I got absolutely amazing, incredible results. Just a few examples. If you measure the height of the Great Pyramid using 27 and a half inches, you get a result of 210 of these, what I'll call right now, KC cubits of 27 and a half inches. And interestingly enough, the archaeologists who have researched the Great Pyramid believe that it originally had 210 tiers to the top.
And we'll be right back with more from Don Carroll here on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. And welcome back to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We'll get right back into my interview with Don Carroll.
So I thought that was an interesting coincidence, particularly in that today's mainstream Egyptologists don't recognize the 27.5-inch Egyptian cubit. They recognize a 17.5-inch cubit they call the little cubit in Egyptology, and they recognize a 20.6-inch cubit called the royal cubit, and they believe the royal cubit was used for it, but they don't recognize this third cubit. You know, as I researched that, I found academic support from it for Dr. Livio Staccini, who was a Harvard PhD, and his specialty was ancient metrology, which is the ancient use of measurements from different societies, because there were many. The Egyptian cubits is one example. So the Hebrews had their own length of a cubit, the Babylonians. So he actually, in his research, wrote that he had found, you know, evidence of what he called this mysterious 27.5-inch cubit in the papyrus, and actually found an example of one in the New York Metropolitan Museum. So now I'm looking at academic support for this unit of measurement. And then as I continued my research, I actually found in the hieroglyphs themselves, in using Budge's two-volume dictionary of hieroglyphs, the mention of a third cubit. This third cubit, though they had a lot of information on the two cubits I mentioned, just simply said a name of a cubit, and it was called it actually translated as the spirit or light cubit, and which of course got my attention, because many believe that the Great Pyramid was much more than a tomb, that it was a place of initiation. And so here is this, you know, light cubit and this evidence for a third cubit from the Egyptians. And then, you know, of course, I pursued that more because as I researched ancient measurements, the ancient measurements in cultures came from, they derived them from body proportions. Examples are the foot, 12 inches we use today. It came from, a general average measurement of the human foot. And we still measure, you know, horses by hand, a 14 or 16 hand horse. And if you go to a fabric store to determine about a yard of fabric, you know, from your center of your chest out to the end of your arm, is considered a yard. These were the type of proportions they used. Da Vinci's Vitruvian Man, that beautiful, amazing drawing by Da Vinci, is exhibiting exactly those type of proportions. And it was considered the reason they used these type of body proportions because for building sacred buildings or classical buildings in ancient times, what better measurements to use than body proportions, since the body was divinely created? What better measurements to mirror your own structures than what was created by the divine? And that was their philosophy. So then I looked into, well, what would be 27.5 inches long? And I mentioned the other yard and foot and hands, why they use those mentions. Well, my research brought me to the length of the spine. The average length of the human spine is 27.9 inches. versus 27.5. I mean, that's less than 2% off. So it's very significant, and significant in many cultures because the spine being seen, you know, as the source, the physical source of our of raising our higher selves. The Eastern traditions called it the Kundalini, or coiled serpent. And here was this, and raising that, you know, brought us closer to the divine, or connected us with the divine. And here was this, for such sites, this perfect measurement to represent that of 27.5 inches, and its significance just fits so perfectly as a site such as this.
Right. Wow, you must have had a lot of moments like that, just aha moments, moments of breakthroughs and epiphanies. I love that.
It was incredible because, you know, as I thought that, well, it was the spine, you know, that it represented the spine, you get one of those, like you said, epiphanies or aha V8 slap the head type moments, because in ancient Egypt, the Giza, what we call the Giza Plateau, was known as the Plateau of Nasru, and it was dedicated to Osiris, you know, their god of the underworld. And Osiris's symbol in ancient Egypt was called the Djed, which translated as Osiris's spine.
Oh, wow.
It was staring me right in the face of how well this fit the height, the width of the Great Pyramid, using that KC or spinal cubit of 27.5 inches, you get 330 of those cubits in width. Well, 33 is also the amount of vertebrae you have in your spine. So, you know, all these things were fitting together. And then I even thought, well, you know, how the spine represents, you know, the higher self, and is represented in the Kundalini, translated from Sanskrit as coiled serpent, and representing, you know, that serpent energy, so to speak. I thought, well, gee, you know, Casey readings talk about, you know, connections between, you know, the Egyptian and Mayan cultures, and going much further back. I wondered that, would this unit of measurement work anywhere else? Well, I got very fortunate that the Mayan archaeologists had done studies of the Mayan pyramids, and they had gone to 3 different Mayan sites and did measurements and studies of 10 different structures at these sites, and they came to a result of that the Mayans used a unit of measurement called a zapal, Z-A-P-A-L. And incredibly, they determined that the zapal was a unit of measurement approximately 55 inches long. And, of course, that was another one of those startling moments, because that's 2 KC cubits of 27.5 inches for their zapal of 55 inches. And, again, the Mayan archaeologists had already done this work for me, and here we are at the Kukulkan pyramid in Chichen Itza, where this unit of measurement works. And the Kukulkan pyramid is the pyramid dedicated to the Mayan deity of the plumed serpent, which is, you know, the serpent with wings, you know, signifying raising that Kundalini serpent energy to the higher self, not keeping it low, but raising it up on wings, so to speak, which is a very common aspect of that symbolism. And so that was, I mean, the work was already done and showing it right there. And then I took it one more step. I had been fortunate enough also to be to Stonehenge. And there's some mention of, I should say, not mention specifically of Stonehenge, but some alluding to Stonehenge in the readings and the research that's been done on Stonehenge by so many of its purpose and reason. That it took about 6 months, but I got, you know, accurate measurements of Stonehenge. Now, Stonehenge is not pyramids, it's circles, primarily 2 stone circles, a blue stone circle, and then the iconic classic Saracen stone circles that we see in the classic pictures, those large lintel circle stones we see. But they're also, you know, they've got the evidence of post-hole circles that went further and further out on Stonehenge, and I was finally able to get accurate measurements of the diameters of the Stonehenge of these circles. And this is one that, again, kind of just slaps you right in the face, the incredible results when you use that spinal Casey qubit of 27.5 inches to measure the diameters of these multiple circles. The results you get using that unit of measurement are 33, 44, 55, 66, 77. I mean, I use the word incredible probably too much, but it is absolutely incredible. It's the only unit of measurement that will give you those results, and I believe way beyond coincidence. I mean, it's seeming to show that this 27.5-inch qubit in these aspects was actually an international unit of measurement at these sacred sites. I mean, three different sites in three different continents getting very significant results.
Wow, that's amazing. I'm sure you built on lots of research that had been out there before you, and I'm sure plenty of scholars are going to be building on your research after they read your book. How do you think that plays into our current theories about the pyramids and the current dates that we have and the methods that we teach in our textbooks about how they're built? How do you think the impact of your personal research and the research to come after you and the research that's already out there, how do you think that's going to play a role in maybe changing the textbooks?
That's going to be very interesting. This is going to be considered alternative archaeology, which, you know, mainstream archaeology, there's going to be some, I'm sure, resistance and difficulty along these lines. I mean, and you're absolutely right. I mean, thank goodness to not only the mainstream archaeological and anthropology researchers, but the alternative researchers in these aspects, because with their information and their writing, you know, was able to give me so much information and spur me on into my own research and my own concepts, what I was bringing together. My hope is that, you know, this is almost in many ways a seminal work of bringing this together, that, you know, this will, with the incredible work so many have done, that, you know, maybe we'll, you know, bring some aha moments or looking at things in different aspects. I mean, in what I write about is, you know, one of the difficulties is the dating system and what it means and how it is. I mean, this, you know, I document, you know, and in the book, I kind of had a smile there, like.
And we'll be right back with more from Don Carroll here on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey. And welcome back to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey. We'll get right back into my interview with Don Carroll.
You know, something like 14 pages of citations and 12 pages of bibliography.
Because, yeah, I noticed that.
Yeah, because, you know, it's like I want to show the documentation that this isn't, you know, just, you know, something that I'm kind of going along with. This is like, here are the sources. Look for yourselves, because, you know, the results, you know, are absolutely incredible. And, you know, I think that will hopefully help more. Now, you know, and I understand the resistance in mainstream archaeology. This is, these are difficult things if you dedicated your life and written books and written textbooks on such things to have this kind of information come out and possibly change, as you said, textbooks, you're really impacting someone's belief system, which is never easy for anyone. If you think about Einstein, and I'm nowhere near any Einstein, but if you think about Einstein with his theory of relativity, they were calling him mad, a crackpot, you know, didn't know what he was talking about, and mainstream physics didn't accept his theory of relativity, now that so much is based upon and found to be correct, for over 20 years.
Right.
So this is, you know, I understand that, you know, and this is a difficult aspect. But I think with time, as people look at the information in there and test it, you know, that they'll see. I mean, one of the things that was talked about in the Casey readings was that the Great Pyramid was basically built between 10,400 and 10,500 BC. Now, for mainstream Egyptologists and archaeologists in general, this was considered absolutely absurd. A good 7,000 years before they considered any megalithic huge stone building was done. We now have evidence in Turkey, Göbekli Tepe, these huge stone, multi-ton stone circles that they found in Göbekli Tepe, and they've excavated four of these stone circles, similar along the lines of Stonehenge. They believe there are 17 to 20 more that are still buried at the site, and they have confidently dated them, the archaeologists themselves, back to about 9500 BC. Well, this is throwing the archaeology community, on its head, because this is, again, we're almost back 7,000 years further than anyone thought that any such megalithic structures were being constructed. And so suddenly there's more and more evidence that perhaps this construction of the Great Pyramid and others goes back to, as the KC readings, and you've had some of 10,400 to 10,500 BC, and you have some phenomenal researchers of Graham Hancock and Adrian Gilbert and Robert Bouval and Dr. Robert Schock, who have shown evidence that the Sphinx and the Great Pyramid go back very possibly with very good scientific evidence from Dr. Schock, the geologist and geophysicist, to 10,000 BC. And, and archaeologists have seen that so many of these ancient sites are tied to astronomy. And there's actually a field in archaeology of archaeoastronomy, because they're finding so many sites were tied to the stars and the seasons and equinoxes and solstices. And what Hancock and Bouval and Gilbert had shown was that at 10,500 BC, their example was Leo, the constellation Leo, at that time was coming directly out of the due east of the horizon, rising up and setting in the due west. And that the Sphinx, the lion on the earth, so to be, kind of that hermetic philosophy of as above, so below, reflecting each other, faces due east. And so at this time of 10,500, you had Leo, the lion constellation, rising, and you had the Sphinx due east, and you had Leo rising due east. And the work of the Orion mystery shows that the belt of what we called Orion, which was a constellation the ancient Egyptians denoted as Osiris, that the plateau of Rostow of Giza was dedicated to, also aligned with the three pyramids. Now, that being said, wonderful research they've done. From that work, I looked into it more, and I found at that time, fascinatingly enough, that, speaking of, triangles and pyramids, is that in the North Sky, which was very important to cultures, because the North Sky is how you navigate. We look in, before we had GPS, shooting the stars, you look for the North Star, to find north and to be able to navigate or find direction from them. I mean, today in the Little Dipper, is Polaris, our North Star. In 3000 BC, it was the North Star, because over thousands of years, due to the precession and the wobble of the Earth, the North Star changes over these thousands of years. And 3000 BC was Thuban in the constellation Draco. But what's amazing at that 10,500, 10,400 period, there wasn't a specific North Star to navigate with, but what you did have was a trinity, a triangle of North Stars that could be used for that and would have great significance. Because one of the other things with the North Stars, those circumpolar stars, is that they never set. And as an example, in the ancient Egyptians, These were the immortal stars, the imperishable stars. Since they never set below the horizon, they were always in the sky. They were eternal. They were immortal. They were imperishable. And that's where the Egyptian soul strived to go to live with these imperishable stars. Well, at 10,500, you had today what we call the summer triangle, and it's called the summer triangle because in the northern latitudes is when you see it best. But in 10,500, those were your north stars, and you would have this triangle of, you know, this pyramid of stars. And what's absolutely, to me, fascinating with it, at that same time, if you look to the southern sky, you had what now today is called the Great Southern Triangle of Stars, or the Winter Triangle of Stars. Well, at 10,500, these were in the southern horizon. So they were connected. Actually, one of the stars was Betelgeuse, which is part of Orion Osiris, was connected there at the shoulder. So the Egyptians at this and the Great Pyramid at this time would have been connected both north, south, east, and west. They would have looked to the south and seen the southern triangle of stars, and they would have looked to the north and seen this imperishable triangle of stars. And looking to the east and west, not only would have the sun been going east and west, but in the evening they would have seen Leo going east and west. You know, creating this axis mundi, as the ancients called it, which is a representative of where heaven and earth meet directly over the Great Pyramid. I mean, just perfect representation, as we talked about, you know, significance, you know, of triangles and trinities occurring in the sky at this very unique time. And now many archaeologists have argued Dr. Schock's results with the Sphinx dating it back so much further, but now we're seeing with Göbekli, there is definitely a possibility of it. And what we're seeing and knowing that the ancients were very familiar with the sky and were phenomenal astronomers, that it was at this time and really this time only that you would have had this incredibly perfect sky above the Great Pyramid, you know, of triangle pyramid fashion of stars in the north, one in the south, and Leo crossing east and west, creating this axis mundi, what some researchers now are calling in Egyptian times what was called Septepi, which was the golden period of when the gods walked on the earth in Egypt, you know, bringing together of heaven and earth occurring at this time and creating, you know, as I called it, this axis mundi above it. So I think over time, and as more research is done, and hopefully this truly, as I feel, the seminal work that I've put out there will ideally inspire others.
It's kind of a two-part question. Why do you think we've lost this knowledge over the years, and why do you think we're getting it back, and what's the purpose that we're going to need, you know, knowing about sacred geometry and knowing about the alignment of stars and why, you know, sacred sites are where they are? How can maybe somebody who isn't familiar with this learn to apply this in their everyday life?
Well, and those are very good questions. I mean, sacred geometry, you can say, I mean, is incorporated in the symbolism of spiritual philosophies and religions throughout the world.
And we'll be right back with more from Don Carroll here on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. And welcome back to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We'll get right back into my interview with Don Carroll.
Really, you could say sacred geometry involves, you know, universal patterns that are used in the design of everything in our reality. Sacred geometry is better known, you know, being found in architecture, sacred architecture, churches, and sacred art. I mean, the simplest example along those lines would be how the Gothic cathedrals were built. They were always built in the shape of a cross because of the importance of that geometric figure to Christianity. It's really, sacred geometry is a belief that mathematical ratios, harmonics and proportions, what we're seeing is that, you know, we seem to have a draw. I mean, how they knew it thousands of years ago, whether they had a more advanced civilization that we realized, you know, or are willing to accept, or through just, you know, spiritual intuitive powers could see the fabric of ourselves and the fabric of the universe brought together, and through that intuitiveness could bring forth these symbols, because I do see them as universal cosmic archetypes. And now, in the latest, some of the latest cutting-edge science and cosmology of trying to understand what the fabric of the universe is, one of the leading theories right now is called CDT, which is much easier to say than the causal dynamical triangulation, which it's short for, and just very briefly, is that one of the leading theories is now is that the fabric of the universe, the space-time fabric of the universe itself, is a mosaic of triangles.
I mean, Buckminster Fuller.
Yes, if you think of a geodesic dome of Buckminster Fuller, that's exactly what they're describing it as.
Right.
And it's different shapes and forms. And that's just all those triangles. And when you look at that Buckminster geodesic dome, in it you can create that six-pointed star, you can in the triangles, and so much more. It's the same concept. And ironically, about 2,500 years ago, Plato, in his writings in Timaeus, had theorized that the fabric of the universe basically was formed in triangles. So
right.
Here we are, again, almost now confirming through what they knew intuitively in science. And so what I think we're seeing here is, you know, that science and spiritual philosophy, unfortunately, so often seems to be at opposite ends. But for me, that's not the case. I understand the scientific method and their process, and there's really a belief system there in its own aspect. As we've seen, it's very hard for them to accept, as the example of Einstein, new ideas, just as spiritual belief systems. But here we're seeing they're really, this spiritual symbolism, sacred geometry, that is pervasive in all aspects, spiritually and science, is showing that they're just two sides of the same coin. And that, you know, if you want to talk about really a grand unified theory, that we're, you know, seeing this in the geometries, in symbolism of spiritual philosophies and how they represented it in their cultures and what it meant, and finding the same meanings in the geometry used in sciences to determine the fabric of ourselves in DNA or the fabric of the universe, you know, in cosmology. And I think what we're seeing is that union, that bringing of heaven and earth together, you know, and I think there's huge potential to see that.
Thank you so much for joining me on the show, Don. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Brent. I'll be talking with you.
Yeah, sounds good. Take care.
Well, that's all the time we have for the show today. I'd like to thank Don Carroll for joining us and talking to us about his new book, Sacred Geometry and Spiritual Symbolism, The Blueprint for Creation. I highly recommend you guys pick up a copy of that. If you want to learn more about Don, visit his website at Donald B. Like and Boy, Carroll, that's CARROLL.com. And don't forget, Don is a featured presenter at the upcoming Ancient Mysteries Conference, entitled When the Morning Stars Sang Together, Our Ancient Celestial Origins and Destiny. And that's here in Virginia Beach from October 10th through the 13th. And if you'd like to register for that, go to the website at www.edgarcasey.org. Click on Events and then click on Conferences. And if you happen to be local here in Virginia Beach like myself, don't forget that Don gives amazing free lectures at the ARE headquarters on things like sacred geometry and the Casey Qubit. If you want to learn more about the schedule for that, go to www.edgarcasey.org. And I want to end the show this week with a thought for the day. The thought for the day this week comes from A Search for God, Book 1. And for those who aren't familiar with the Search for God books, they are another wonderful resource that came out of the Edgar Casey material, and I highly recommend you guys check them out. This is from the chapter entitled Patience from A Search for God, Book 1, and it reads, "The beauty of the soul shows in the life of an individual who has patience. This comes to those who have a constant prayerful attitude for a purposeful life. In order to have this beauty of the soul's expression, it is necessary that we forget ourselves. It is not altogether an outward growth, but an inward one too. It is the result of introspection, which is the foundation of deep meditation. Love is manifested in every word and act, even as it was in those of the Master. So, through patience, let us magnify his attributes in our experience. There is nothing to regret in exercising patience. There is everything in the loss of it. We are building for eternity. Results do not always manifest at once." And I love this so much for a lot of reasons, but I would say the last sentence, it says, "We are building for eternity. Results do not always manifest at once." I love this because that is the definition of patience, in my opinion. To understand that things are always at work behind the scenes, and we aren't always conscious of everything that's going on. We're building a long, long process. We're on a long journey of many lifetimes, reincarnating and learning lessons, working with patterns. So the results that we want, unfortunately, aren't always going to come in the way that we want them to and when we want them to. Patience is an evolutionary virtue, and it comes with time. It's a process. It's a growth process of working with these patterns. And just remember, if you continue to work with these patterns, you will continue to be rewarded. And continue to keep a positive attitude throughout that. Don't beat yourself up along the way. You're always making progress, whether or not you can see that. I want to thank everybody so much for listening. I really appreciate you guys taking time out of your busy schedules to listen to me talk to these incredible speakers and share some wonderful wisdom with you guys. If you remember, please check out the Facebook page for Reflections, The Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. I'd love to hear you guys' comments and feedback. I'm your host, Brenton Bickerstaff. And until next week, guys, y'all have a wonderful week. And I hope it's filled with tons and tons of laughter and love. Take care, y'all.